Hey guys, Charlie here. A quick reminder before we kick off today's episode that Will and I are coming back to the live stage April 7th at the Basement Comedy Club in Melbourne. We're doing another TOEFOP Live. It'll be me, it'll be Will, it'll be special guest Deeksie, most likely, and you'll want to be there. There's a link in the episode description, so check it out once you've listened to this awesome show.
A Listener Production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Everyone relax. You are in the video store with me, Charlie Clawson, and the Sultan of Cinema, the maestro of the movies, the Pharaoh of the flicks. I'm a bit out of practice. It's been a while. Guy Davis, welcome back to the video store. How are you? The new Everyone Relax approved video store. Welcome to our new feed.
I was about to say, your Michael Buffer's not quite on today with your let's get ready to rumble various nicknames kind of thing, but I still appreciate it. Yeah, everybody relax. Welcome to the video store. No shirt, no shoes, no service, but, yeah, happy to talk about what's the topic today, Charlie? Actually, you hit me up with this one.
In a rare instance, when I normally rely on you, Guy, with your encyclopedic knowledge of films to come up with a good topic, this one occurred to me because I was watching one of my favorite movies, and to the point where it's not just one of my favorite movies, but I believe the lead character in it is actually my style icon, and that is, of course, Brad Pitt in California. He is so good in that film. But the whole time I was watching it, I was like, man, like this was really early on in his career. If he decided that this was just how he wanted to be known, then he could have had an excellent career just playing like the Ben Foster type roles, just the sort of shifty bad guy. The only thing working against him is he looks incredible. He is so good looking that you have incredibly conflicted feelings watching California because he's such a monster and he's so reprehensible, but fuck, he's sexy. He's just got that white trash sex appeal going down.
I don't know if you're going to be manufacturing TikToks or short video clips out of this to put on social media, but to those listeners who can actually see Charlie, he's very much rocking the early Grace look today. He's got the trucker cap.
Yep,
he's showing off the shoulders, and that facial hair is both unkempt yet amazing. A goal, you might say.
I mean, I say this unironically, but like I do honestly look at the way Brad Pitt dresses in California. I'm like, that look suits me. Just the kind of like loose fitting kind of singlets and muscle tees and trucker caps and short sleeve shirts. I don't have the kind of sort of gagging thing that he does the whole way through the film. But I was watching that and I was like, what are some of the best against type roles? And it's a topic that you and I, in the discussion of it, you know, when we're messaging back and forth, because we both instinctively went straight to Tom Cruise. I think you said Tom Cruise. No, I said Tom Cruise in Collateral. You said Tom Cruise in, was it Magnolia?
Interview with the Vampire.
And then we started laughing. It's like, well, actually, maybe Tom Cruise doesn't play against type. Maybe he's just a really good actor who can play lots of different roles.
Yeah, who's just, you know, quite diverse and, you know, willing to tackle new challenges. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, and I think something that came up from that Cruise conversation as well, I mean, of course, you know, he's got the Cruise stereotype, which is the all-American go-getter. You know, he's got a lot of losers in his body of work, which I find really interesting. But he also has a fair few villains. And I think we tend, when we think of against-type performances, we generally think of heel turns.
Yeah.
We generally think of leading men playing bad guys or comedians especially playing bad guys. I mean, you know, you had a real run where you had guys like Robin Williams in Insomnia or Michael Keaton did a few of those certainly.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks hasn't really done that many. I think he took a stab at it with Road to Perdition.
And Elvis kind of.
Oh, and recently in Elvis, yeah. But even then, he's like...
Yeah, I mean, because I was thinking about Colin Farrell as well, because I'm like a Colin Farrell in The Batman, but It's similar to Elvis. I feel like if you just get in a big fat suit and becoming completely unrecognizable, then that's not against type. You know, what is, you know, the contradiction of Brad Pitt in California is he looks, for all intents and purposes, like Brad Pitt, but he's playing a monster. Like, even, you know, like I have some honorable mentions, like, you know, Charlize Theron in Monster. Like, that's a clear against type performance and casting. But again, I'm like, well, she's not really playing it. She's like, that's a completely different character where she's wearing, like, you know, they've put on that makeup on her, changed her, put in dentures, all that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
I understand it's a kind of nebulous definition of against type, and it is probably quite subjective. But I'm looking for people who are essentially playing themselves with no bells and whistles. It's just the character that we have come to know them as, they're playing the complete opposite.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, I mean, when you're talking about actors, and of course you're going to know a lot more about this than I am, but I mean, I think actors certainly have definite skill sets, and even ones that you can, that are generally regarded as kind of one note or perhaps limited, if they're deployed really well and perhaps in a role that just requires, you know, a slight degree of difficulty or even just a little twist on what they're normally renowned for, it can be regarded as like a, oh my God, this person has hitherto unforeseen debts. I mean, I think about Eastwood a bit this way. I mean, there are times when he will take, you know, his traditional persona, but you'll put it in the context of Unforgiven, and you're looking at it going, oh, wow, there's more to this guy than we imagine. It's like, I don't think he's playing all that different.
That's interesting. It's the genre around him changes rather than the character.
Yeah, or the quality of the project changes. And similarly with Adam Sandler to some degree as well. I mean, I think there are occasions when he was certainly trying to break out of the kind of roles and taking something that appeared a little more challenging. And when he really tried to do that, I was like, you're not bad. You're doing pretty well. But, I mean, when very savvy filmmakers, and I'm thinking of Paul Thomas Anderson here in Punch Drunk Love, takes the Sandler persona, puts it just, twists the dial just a little bit and also changes the context. Like, oh, all that wild manic stuff that he was doing in, say, Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore, when you put it in the context of this love story and this guy who's got, you know, deep, deep wells of anger and is able to sort of quell that through the, finding love and finding self-respect as a result, it's really, really interesting. And he sort of, it's not even a matter of rising to the occasion. It's like, oh, you found what fits.
Yeah.
Or you found like a really... You found a really great suit off the rack, or one that was tailored to you, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's an underrated skill for an actor is not only knowing what scripts to choose, but also who to collaborate with. You know, you sort of look at Arnie when he was sort of at the peak of his action hero phase, and then he looked to Ivan Reitman. And he's like, oh, you know, maybe I could do something with this guy. And now it's sort of like this formula for every action hero is you do, you know, four action films and then one family thing where you're running like a pound or something like that, you know, some family-friendly fodder. But I think that still doesn't fit the definition of what I want to talk about today, you know. Like Arnie's still Arnie. They've just, you know, changed the setting that he's in.
Yeah, things like that seem more like savvy career moves than a desire to kind of, I don't know, expand your skill set or, you know, stretch yourself. Yeah. But I think some of the actors we've talked about here, I mean, they're generally regarded as fairly versatile.
Yeah.
Players.
Like Gary Oldman, for instance, you could never say, oh, he played against type, because it's like, what's a Gary Oldman type?
Yeah.
Maybe romantic lead? Like, I've never really seen him play like a suave. Oh, I guess Dracula, he was kind of suave in a Victorian context.
In a vampiric kind of way.
But he was a sexy dude. Like, you know, he's shirtless and long hair and stuff.
He was. And, yeah, more than I expected, actually. I mean, I revisited Bram Stoker's Dracula not long ago, and I must admit when I...
Horny.
I remember Horny reading film. About the initial... the pre-production, that was like, oh, we wanted Daniel Day-Lewis. And it's like, oh, shit, he would have been perfect.
Yeah.
And then they're talking, oh, we looked at Antonio Banderas. Oh. We looked at a couple of unknown guys like Ralph Fiennes. It's like, ooh, all these would have been good. Gary Oldman? I mean, you know, you sort of remembered him from Sid and Nancy. I don't know if JFK was prior to Dracula. But I'll prick up your ears as well. I mean, he was just generally regarded as this kind of grubby kitchen
character
sink Brit.
Actor. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But for him, and someone you got to play sort of like scuzzy guys.
Yeah.
But he was so, and he, you know, certainly brought some degree of scuzziness to Dragon, but also he had just this incredible sense of romanticism and yearning that really, really worked. He had such great chemistry with Winona Ryder in that.
And there's also some against type performances which are so effective that changes the entire course of an actor's career. I'm thinking of like Bruce Willis in Die Hard. You know, it's very hard for, you know, people of a millennial generation and younger to understand that we knew Bruce Willis as like a TV funny man, like a Ryan Reynolds-esque, fast-talking, quick-witted, you know, not sitcom star, but TV star. And so then to see him in a grimy white singlet running around with a machine gun, it was like, what? David Addison knows how to fight? When did that happen?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in Moonlighting, whenever he got into a fight, he generally got his ass kicked.
Yeah. Well, I guess John McClane gets his ass kicked as well. He just, you know, he uses like cunning and determination to win in the end. But then the other one that is probably the most kind of like stark a difference in terms of the front half of the career and the back half of the career is Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen, who all through the 50s and 60s was the stoic captain or doctor or whatever it was, then in One Foul Swoop with the Zsasz Boys just becomes like the master of deadpan comedy. And from that point, you can never look at him the same. You go back and watch his old films now, it's virtually impossible not to see Frank Drebin.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, from Flying High to Police Squad to the Naked Gun movies and that, and then all these rather sort of, well, lesser comedies that came in the wake of that, all of which he really committed 100% in, by the way. I mean, they're terrible movies for the most part, but, I mean, he's never phoning it in. He's always like, no, I'm here to deliver the laughs the way I do it, and, you know, I'm gonna do it. But, I mean, yeah, it's funny watching Flying High with this collection of, like, but yeah, especially those guys you're talking about, like Peter Graves, Lloyd Bridges, all these very four square kind of leading men guys from the 50s, 60s, 70s or whatever. And they're all, you know, playing it dead straight. It's funny. I mean, Lloyd Bridges is hilarious in Flying High, but he never really sort of took it and ran with it the way Nielsen did. Nielsen really sort of nailed it.
He had a brief revival with the Hot Shots films. Lloyd Bridges playing the Admiral and then the President of the United States. And I would argue that's even better than Flying High. Different kind of role. He's playing more the Frank Drebin, bumbling kind of, you know, politician and Admiral or whatever he is. But he is so adept at that kind of comedy.
Nielsen just so commits to the bit. I mean, you're making me want to rewatch Flying High because he's just so great in that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what would be the modern equivalent? Like, it'd be like taking who's like the straightest? Like,
Liam Neeson is trying it.
Yeah, right. Is he? Is he doing comedy now?
He's got that thing in Ted or Ted 2.
With the
teddy bear, where he goes to the teddy bear's working behind like the count, working a checkout at a supermarket.
Is that
Liam Neeson?
I mean, I know Liam Neeson's seen Ted 2, but I absolutely cannot remember one single thing about it.
I think with Ted 2, it's like, oh, we'll bring in Sam Jones from Flash Gordon because they talk about Flash Gordon a lot. But I think it's in Ted 1 where...
Isn't Sam Jones in he's in Ted 1, not Ted 2.
Oh, is he in Ted 1?
I think it's the other way around. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they used their Sam Jones ticket in Ted 1. And there must be Liam Neeson in Ted 2?
Yeah, but he goes to the supermarket checkout and he's like, they're saying this tricks is for kids, but is it just for kids? So it'll be all right if I eat it. I think he's been doing a lot of that really sort of steering into that stoic Taken style persona that he created. And he did it in, was it Extras or Life's Too Short?
One of those. Life's Too Short. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And he also was in another Seth MacFarlane movie. I think he was in like the Western one that he did where he's basically just playing Liam Neeson, but again, in a comedic context and just playing it so straight and gruff. It's like, you know, to quote Rainier Wolfcastle, that's the joke.
Okay, well, let's get into it. We each have our nominations. Mine have changed slightly since I texted you. I'm going to open with a new entrant, a last-minute entry that I was thinking about on the way here. And in many ways, this performance sums it up because the actress starts off playing what she's most widely known for and then switches halfway through, and that is Gina Davis in The Long Kiss Goodnight. Now, I know this is a bit of a line ball one because she had done action before with like Pirate Island or whatever it's called, Pirate Bay. Not Pirate Bay, Torrent site. Cutthroat Island. But in The Long Kiss Goodnight, she literally lampoons her kind of Thelma and Louise persona of like the ditzy kind of, you know, housewife, and then the switch change when the Manchurian Candidate style, her inner assassin is awakened and she becomes a bleach blonde assassin. And she's so good in those dual roles, but it felt like, you know, they were setting up a new franchise. Like it was Shane Black wrote it, right?
Yeah, and both Cutthroat Island and Long Kiss Goodnight were directed by Rennie Harlan, who I think was her husband at the time.
That's right. And that was back when Rennie Harlan was still kind of like the great white hope of action cinema. They were like, oh, well, this guy, he'll figure it out eventually. And now I don't know what he's doing, but it's not easy. He's the Simon West of Michael Bay's.
He's still going. He just directed like this. I don't think you call them direct to video anymore. What do you call it? It's not quite direct to streaming, but like VOD, like video on demand.
Yeah, yeah. In Australia, he directed one with Aaron. I believe, wasn't it? It was in New Zealand. I think it was in New Zealand or Australia. He just directed a film.
This one's called The Bricklayer. With Aaron Eckhart, who seems to have got a whole new career as like a, you know, video on demand tough guy. He's got like maybe three or four of them out at the moment.
He's going the Thomas Jane route.
He kind of is. I mean, he always looked like Thomas Jane. You thought that Thomas Jane was the, the Matt Damon of Aaron Eckhart's or something.
Mate, we are disappearing up our own ass this episode.
But, yeah, I mean, it seemed like only yesterday that Aaron Eckhart was like, oh, are you the next Redford? You're kind of, you're a pretty versatile leading man and very, very handsome and, you know, you're doing well in The Dark Knight, and now he's making these, you know, cheap-ass Rennie Harlan actioners.
It's really hard because we don't have movie stars anymore. Like movie stars are no longer bankable like they used to be. So unless you have your own franchise or Bourne property or you're attached to a Marvel film or whatever, you've got no real way of getting a wide release because it's not like the old days where, you know, Rain Man was the highest grossing film of, you know, 1988 and it was about a con man and his autistic brother. Like that's kind of insane when you think about that's what a blockbuster was 20-something years ago. Now, unless it's a recognized property or, you know, previous existing IP, you're not going to get it. So you've got big stars like even people who have done Marvel films like Chris Evans. Like Chris Evans is not a big star. Hemsworth, apart from Thor, can't seem to get anything going cinematically, maybe on Netflix or whatever. But we have sort of sold the farm for recognizable IP, I think, when it comes to having movie stars.
Absolutely. By the way, I hate to break it to you, but when you say 20 years ago, you actually mean 40 years ago.
Oh, is that really? Oh, my God. Yeah, I do.
Oh, well, you said 88. I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a long time. Oh, man. Getting closer to 40. Oh, that's insane.
Father Time's here to kick your ass around the block. But yeah, let's talk more about Samantha Kane, a.k.a. Charlie Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such it felt like they were setting up for a film franchise, and I would totally be in to see, like, you know, the future adventures. Samuel L. Jackson in a great supporting role with one of the best, like, it's such a Shane Black-esque running gag, the whole thing about how he has to hum the blues riff to kind of remember things.
I got my keys.
I still do that. To this day, like if I'm doing the dishes or something, I'm like, da-na-na-na-na. You got to put the things in the sink, da-na-na-na-na, turn on the water.
It's good advice. And I mean, yeah, Long Kiss Goodnight. I mean, Shane Black really misses as far as I'm concerned, but this is just chock full of like just fantastic one-liners. I mean, Gina, you know, gets a heap of them. But yeah, Samuel L. Jackson just gets a bunch and really makes the most of them. I mean, I think Gina's like being, you know, accosted by some thugs or something. Samuel L. Jackson shows up and puts a gun in his ear and says, "This ain't no ham on rye." And he says, "Oh, I would have been here quicker, but I was busy thinking up that ham on rye line."
I mean, it's funny. Obviously, Gina Davis. There was a period of time, perhaps when she was with Rennie, where she was like keen to make that move, and she sort of has the kind of attributes of a Charlize Theron, where she looks athletic and imposing. And if she wanted to do action movies, and so I don't know if it was a thing of like, it was just, she was ahead of the time. We weren't ready for it because it has, there's a few of those kind of 90s action films, which it's like, oh, why isn't this a bigger hit? Because it seems to have all the hallmarks of, you know, a film that would do well, but for whatever reason, it just didn't catch on. I reckon it's a real shame. I would have loved to have seen what Gina Davis had done in that genre.
It is a shame because, I mean, at the start of the 90s, you've got Arnold and Total Recall basically doing the same thing. And then at the start of the 2000s, you've got Matt Damon and The Bourne Identity basically doing the same thing. Yeah, but, you know.
Action heroes got smaller, like got more normal. Since The Matrix, I think. The Matrix is to blame.
I think so, yeah. But, I mean, you're right about Gina Davis as well. She's got, you know, great stature.
Yeah.
I mean, she stands about, what, 6'1"
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, like her fight scene. I mean, I don't know how much of how many of her own stunts she did in The Long Kiss Goodnight, but the way it's shot, it looks like it's her. Like, because that is the hardest part of, you know, I mean, I love the movie Annihilation, but I just cannot buy Natalie Portman as a soldier. Like, seeing her hold a rifle is the most unconvincing thing in the world. But Charlize Theron, you know, Gina Davis, yeah, I believe they could kick my ass if it came down to it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll throw Angelina Jolie in that that mix as well. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Tomb Raider movie she did. I think they're kind of iffy, but the way she throws her whole body into a punch, it's like, I don't know if you're a legitimately good fighter, but I mean, you're a great screen fighter.
Yeah,
you're right about Jolie. So, well,
I guess when your dad's John Voight, you've probably got some latent anger somewhere. All right, who's your first nom?
My first nom is, I think if you've listened to Video Shop more than once, you'll probably know that there are recurring themes, certainly recurring names that come up, and one of them is Christopher Walken.
Come on, do the voice.
I was going to say, one of the funniest things I saw the other day was someone put on Twitter, aka X, an interview with Dave Grohl, where he was remembering the time the Foo Fighters appeared on Saturday Night Live and Walken was the host. So, of course, you always have, ladies and gentlemen, music guest is such and such. And apparently Walken came up to Dave Grohl, and Grohl did this fantastic, you know, Walken impression that I'm going to try and replicate here. But, like, so is the accent on Foo or Fighters? And Dave Grohl's like, I really want to hear him say it in a way that Christopher Walken would say it. So he said, it's Fighters. And then normally you say Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
But then Walken goes out on stage to introduce us, ladies and gentlemen, Foo Fighters.
That's top-notch Walken too. Congratulations to you and Dave Grohl on an excellent Walken.
I've spent decades refining it. But, yeah, I mean, look, Walken's been one of my guys, well, again, yeah, for probably 40 years, because – the first time I really tweaked to him was when I saw The Dead Zone back in 84. He starred in David Cronenberg's adaptation of Stephen King's great novel, The Dead Zone. And I thought, oh, I'm sure I'd seen this guy before, but, yeah, just the way he would put this particular spin on lines, just the cadence of his speech, just the way he looks, and, you know, he's a great silent actor, he's a great reactive actor, all that really kicked in for me. But, you know, generally he's regarded as a villain or someone you just can't trust. You know, that probably happened from the mid-80s onwards. He's got this great 1-2 punch of he's a Bond villain in View to a Kill. And then he's in a really great movie called At Close Range with Sean Penn.
Oh, yes, At Close Range, yeah.
He's just dialing up the Walken in that one. I mean, he's really just putting, some hot sauce on delivery of these lines. He's got these fantastic monologues. He looks just satanic. So, yeah, and then in the 90s you're off at the races because you've got King of New York, you've got Batman Returns, you've got True Romance.
True Romance.
And, of course, you have Wayne's World too.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. But even at that time, I mean, prior to all that, though, I mean, I think at the very beginning of his career, he's regarded as someone who was you normally played characters who were sensitive, maybe too sensitive for this world, and or a bit spacey. Mm. I mean, he's got a great bit in Annie Hall where he's sort of
driving.
He's Diane Keaton's brother, and he's sort of talking to Woody Allen about how he has this fantasy of driving into another car.
I think about that scene every time I'm driving at night and I see headlights traveling towards me. I always think about that scene.
Oh, my God, Wayne is coming.
Yeah.
And but it's got that great cut of walk and then driving him to the airport. He's got this great serene look in his face. Diane Keaton's like, fine, my brother's driving me to the airport. Woody Allen just looks terrified. Yeah. So great. And, of course, the Deer Hunter, which he won the Oscar for. I mean, his character is really interesting in that, his character of Nick. I mean, it seems like he and Robert De Niro's characters are sort of like the alpha males of this group of friends from this mining town. They're equally kind of blokes you can trust or leader types. De Niro is able to sort of survive what happens to them in Vietnam. Walken just can't. It really breaks him. And it leads to this really, really heartbreaking ending that Walken really sells. But yeah, generally is known as like a bad guy for, you know, certainly people of our generation, I think, which made my Against Type performance such a surprise to me, at least. It's when he played DiCaprio's father in Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
In 2002. I think it's another really, I mean, he's a really, really good actor. Let's not split hairs about that. He got nominated for an Oscar for this performance, but it's one that I think a lot of people weren't expecting because he does have a lot of Walken traits in it, in that, you know, he's like, what kind of father are you that you created this son who is a compulsive scam artist who doesn't seem to have any identity of his own, that is constantly moving from scam to scam? Yeah, I mean, it's and then the scenes that they have together, you get some indication of like, this is a man who really loves his son, but he's weak and he's flawed. And he can't sort of, he wants to do right by somebody, he can't set a good example because he's not a good person or he's a weak person. Yeah. And, you know, it would be easy to try and make the character a bit more sophisticated or angry or whatever. But Walken actually just sort of plays him as a quiet guy who's got big dreams and has bravado but can't follow through. He's got no follow through.
Yeah.
It's really similar in a way.
Spielberg deploys him in a similar way that PTA deploys Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, in the sense that there is an archetype here that we're working with, but let's delve deeper into the psychology of the quirks and the kind of offbeat charm and stuff. And, you know, because he has that quality as Frank Abagnale Senior, of being like, you know, like a fast talker and charming and all that kind of stuff. But what is the motivation behind it? But I think it's interesting because we all like Walken, for all his oddballness, is incredibly charming. Like it's endearing, maybe a little kind of sinister in parts. Like, you know, if he dials up that element of it, but this is kind of, you're right, they dial up the humanity. And so he is incredibly charming, but it's kind of like there's more everyman to him in this rather than being from Planet X.
It is. I mean, look, I wouldn't trade any of Walken's Planet X performances for anything. They're so marvelous. They're so entertaining. The word iconic gets overused, particularly by me, but they really are. But then you see him in something like this, or you see him in something like, I think around the early 90s as well, he did maybe two telly movies with Glenn Close, and they're based on these sort of prairie tales. One of them's called Sarah Plain and Tall.
Oh, yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, and she's like, it's a privilege to say like a mail order bride, but she like answers this letter. This was back in the old West or something, where, you know, people would write and say, I'm a widower, I need help raising my two kids. I've got a farm, you'll be provided for, all this kind of stuff. And people would answer. It's like the early version of Tinder. And, you know, she's this semi-sophisticated woman, I think from Boston or something, who then goes to, you know, live in the Midwest with Christopher Walken and his two kids. And he's like this very stoic, standoffish, not an emotional guy, but they gradually warm to each other. And there's at the end where they actually sort of, you can tell that they fall in love with each other. It's not overplayed, but it's really just lovely. And it's like, I wouldn't have expected this from you, Chris Walken. It's like when Clint Eastwood did Bridges of Madison County. It's like,
yeah,
I didn't see this coming.
Or any time like, you know, Robin Williams' Awakenings or Good Will Hunting, where he just tampers down the zaniness, yeah, you know, or Carrie in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. There's like, oh, wow, you put your one wood away and you're now trying to find another gear. Like, it's funny too, because you think about the Robin Williams one, and he was like a, you know, good candidate for this category, but then it became sort of like, I think, a bit not predictable. That sounds like I'm being dismissive of it, but it's like, oh, it's a beard movie for Robin Williams. Like, here comes a Robin Williams beard performance. If he's got a beard on, you know he's being serious. No beard, we're going to get Patch Adams. While we're talking about actors, you know, who kind of took what they're sort of known for and changed it completely, you know, whether that's Walken or Bruce Willis, the next actor I want to talk about did this 100%, and that's Michael Keaton in Batman. Now, let us take you, dear listener, back to pre-internet time. 1988, when they announced that they were going to be making a new live-action version of Batman. And not only had they tapped the director of Beetlejuice, but they had also tapped Mr. Mum himself, Michael Keaton. Now, if this had happened in the age of the internet, it possibly could have melted down. Like, there was a concerted, like, letter-writing campaign to Warner Brothers from every comic book nerd around the world saying, this is going to piss in the face of everything that we love about Batman. We were so sick of the, you know, the 60s show destroyed the legacy, which is so ridiculous because it's a fucking comic book character and can be interpreted in many different ways. But fans were like, and I remember because I was a Keaton fan from way back. Like, I remember seeing Night Shift and like, Billy Blazejowski is my guy. Like, I love him. And it's a similar thing to Bruce Willis, and you know, he made his name as a fast-talking kind of like comic character, like comedic actor.
Yeah.
And this is before we understood, like, what modern superhero costuming was going to look like. We're all thinking of Christopher Reeve in, the, like, that thin spandex or Adam West or whatever. But then I remember seeing that first trailer as a kid and just being like, holy shit. Like, you've got to understand, like, we are now overrun with comic book movies and they suck mostly. But there was an era where if you're a comic book fan, like, you would just please just someone – just take it a little bit seriously. Just don't make fun of it. Just, like, you know, treat it as the characters if they have, like, integrity. And that performance of his, I think, is, like, I know everyone loves, you know, there's a lot of affection for it, but if you actually break down to the impact it had on every subsequent portrayal of Batman, he was the first one to do the voice. No one had ever thought of changing the voice. And I remember as a kid being like, why is he changing his voice? Oh, it's different to his Bruce Wayne voice. Like, what a brilliant... like, decision for an actor to make. The easiest thing in the world would just be, like, to nod and wink and just... but he decided to give, like, the to commit to the psychology of the character, which is this is a guy who lives in duality. He's tortured by his past. You know, this Bruce Wayne is just a front. He's actually really more Batman, all this kind of stuff. And then when you sort of partner with that amazing set design and, you know, that Tim Burton influence, like, the whole thing just felt so different, you know, like, just and so far from Mr. Mum or Gung Ho or Touch and Go or whatever middling kind of sub Tom Hanks projects he was doing, you know, prior to Batman.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when prior to him landing, you know, the Batman role, he's had a comeback with Beetlejuice. Because you're right about Night Shift. I mean, Billy Blaze, that's just, you know, that's star making right out of the gate. You're like, holy shit, who's this guy? Then, of course, you do a little research and realize that Keaton had been sort of knocking around for a while as a stand-up, as a sketch guy on various shows. But, yeah, this was his real sort of breakout performance. And you think, oh, my God, this guy's going to take over the world. And it really – when was Night Shift? That was like 82?
82, yeah.
Yeah, and Beetlejuice is maybe 88. He had like 6 years, not in the weeds necessarily, but, I mean, it was like, is this guy ever sort of going to capitalize on – what we thought he could do. He was in, like, things like, as you said, Touch and Go. Mr. Mom was a hit, and Mr. Mom was really good. You're right. That was a good follow-up. Yeah.
Well, I think, we talked about, like, an actor's ability to pick scripts. I don't think Michael Keaton is that great at picking scripts. I think his talent has got him to a level where periodically really great directors will go, oh, he'll be great if I deploy him like this. But then you look at his choices in between those hits and it's like, oh my God, like Herbie the Love Bug, you know, like that's Jack Frost, Speechless. Like he does these, the paper is fine, I guess, but it's all quite middling. I think now he's actually in his best era because, you know, he's since Birdman, people are like, oh, look, this dude can really do a lot of different things. Let's sort of like try him out.
But that's the thing. And when he's on, he's on. And it sort of buys you maybe 5 years of goodwill where you can do a few Speechlesses or something like that. But it's like, remember, like, he was pretty good in Birdman. It's like, oh, yeah, that's right, Michael Keaton.
I mean, that same year he did Batman 2, he did another film, Clean and Sober, which is kind of like, I mean, it feels like a bit movie of the week because it's about like, you know, an addict who sort of goes into rehab. But the opening scene is him in a hotel room blowing a line of coke and then going to talk to the sex worker he's with and realizing she's dead. And so that is a bold choice for an actor who's mostly known for like family-friendly comedies to then like choose that movie in the same year that you do Batman. Like that's a pretty ballsy choice.
It's a really good 1-2 punch of, well, actually 1-2-3 punch of, you know, Beetlejuice sort of reestablishes his comic bona fides because he's great in it. He's really hilarious. And just manic. And it's like, oh, yeah, he does this and he does this better than just about anybody working. Clean and Sober was clearly a gear shift because I don't think we'd seen him do anything serious prior to that. And it's like, oh, he can, you know, he's got a few things in the toolkit. But then, to do Batman, I mean, because you think about the guys or the leading men who were around at that time. I mean, I remember seeing like Alec Baldwin on the rise and thinking, oh, my God, this guy was genetically designed to be Bruce Wayne. You know, just put him in a dinner suit and it's like, ah, of course. And he's got that sort of
Mel Gibson,
absolutely. I think Ray Liotta was in the running. Ray Liotta was probably in the running for both Batman and the Joker. But, you know, when I heard that it was Michael Keaton reuniting with Tim Burton for Batman, it's like, oh, so he's the Joker. That's neat. That's good. That works. And then you hear, oh no, Nicholson's the Joker, Keaton is Batman. It's like, it's going to take a while for me to wrap my head around this, but you're right about that trailer. Because, you know, when he grabs that terrified thug and, who are you? It's like, and he does it, I'm Batman. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in. Tell me more.
And you look at like Christian Bale's Batman and, like there's a lot of signposts to that performance. Like it's a completely different performance and Bale does what Bale does, but the voice, the physicality, the kind of broodiness, all that kind of stuff, I think you can sort of trace back to Michael Keaton. The perfect example is just look at George Clooney and Val Kilmer's Batman. They don't get it. Like that's just like George Clooney wearing a rubber suit. That's just Val Kilmer wearing a rubber suit.
Clooney was, very poorly cast. I don't mind Kilmer so much. I think what you've got in those two movies is very much, it's more Joel Schumacher than it is the person in the bat suit.
Yeah.
And I don't think Clooney's a bad Bruce Wayne. I think he's a terrible Batman. I don't think Batman and Robin gives you that good of Bruce Wayne either. I kind of like what Kilmer does, but Kilmer's playing a bit more lighter or a bit lighter. Mm. And he did it to the best of my, to my liking, even better in Batman Returns as well. I think he's pretty good in that.
I agree. I mean, it was funny. The 90s for Keaton is a bit of a, 90s into the early, pretty much all the 2000s. But the 90s was where he tried to take a bit of that currency and go, I'm going to test my villain bona fides now. So I'm going to be in like Pacific Heights. I'm going to do Desperate Measures. And Pacific Heights is okay. It's just the stakes aren't high enough. It's like, oh, I've got a bad tenant. It's kind of like feels like a bit, I don't know. I mean, if you describe the day, it'd be a bit boomerish. It's like the problem of landlords.
You're losing your flat.
And then Desperate Measures, like, is such a weird, like, it's a collection of influences, Babette Schroeder, and it's like he's trying to do Silence of the Lambs, but it's also an action movie. And there's just this ridiculous scene in which Andy Garcia steals a cop's motorbike, and it's the worst edit point where it goes from Andy Garcia to stuntman riding a motorbike. Like, it's cartoonishly bad. And so it's like, he's just not being utilized in the right way. And then it took till Birdman, for people to go, oh, this guy is pretty good, but you just got to know how to use him because he seems to have terrible instincts himself.
That's right. Well, I mean, the main thing I remember about Desperate Measures is they introduce Michael Keaton as like this Hannibal Lecter-ish master criminal or whatever. He's in like his solitary cell and he's got like a pair of horn-rimmed glasses on. It's like, oh, shorthand that he's smart, but he's also like pumping weights with
doing weights like Cape Fear.
And they're
That's what I mean. It's a collection of influences. You can see every film that it's trying to be, but it's actually nothing itself. I mean, side point, I think we've mentioned this, like Keaton's my guy. Like he's like my favorite actor. I've always loved Michael Keaton. I even have a little Batman Returns figurine standing on my desk just out of shot here. But even more than that, my wife, Gemma, when we were courting each other like 20 years ago, we were having a long distance relationship and we were on the phone and we were talking and she's like, oh, actually, I got to go. There's a Michael Keaton movie on right now and I love Michael Keaton. I was like, what? You love Michael Keaton. It was a real like Mindy and Homer moment where I was like, oh no, I'm a goner. I can't fall in love with a girl who loves Michael Keaton. That's too much Keaton love.
I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but when I was courting my lovely girlfriend Lou, we were, sort of communicating via text and she's asking, it's all getting to know you stuff. And it's like, what kind of music do you like? And she said, oh, I don't know, it sounds a bit daggy, but I'm actually really into Steely Dan. And I said, I'm going to send you a racy picture now. And I sent her a picture of my Steely Dan box set because they're one of my favorite bands. I'm like, okay, this is meant to be. True and love. We're coming up on our 5-year anniversary. So I guess it was.
Oh, congrats. All right. Who's your next nomination for Against Type?
This is a little sad, actually, because look, we're recording this on the 1st of February. Mm. And the 2nd of February 2024 marks the 10-year anniversary of the death of one of the great American actors of recent times, and that's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
I mean, we're still feeling the hit. We're still feeling the loss from that one as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there aren't a lot of modern actors who have passed away where I'm like, I mean, I'll be like, oh, man, that sucks. You know, I mean, losing Matthew Perry recently was kind of like, oh, man, he seemed like, he was sort of turning around, getting it together, all this kind of stuff. But, I mean, thinking about Hoffman, and thinking about he'd had a really great career for about 25 years or so, and seemed like one of those guys who was only going to get better. You could picture him just aging well and doing great stuff and finding even more strings on the instrument. And for him to go the way he did and to learn that he sort of had, to maybe surmise that he had a lot of demons and he was often down on himself and all that kind of stuff. You're just going to go, oh, shit, man. So, I mean, that's really, really sad because, a performance of his will come up and you're like, God, you were good. And you could do just about anything. And
yeah, that's the thing, isn't it, right? Like talk about, I mean, it's almost like every role he played was against type because of the way he presented, but he could be funny, he could be menacing, he could be romantic. Like the dude just had charisma by the bucket load.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, he got his start sort of playing jerks and pricks in the early 90s. I mean, he's in Scent of a Woman as one of Chris O'Donnell's school frenemies who's just, this clearly comes from money and doesn't really care about anything. There's a nice through line bit from that character through to Talented Mr. Ripley.
The 90s with like villainous preppy boys? Like I think of like School Ties, it was a whole subgenre in the, Dead Poets Society, like villainous preppy boys.
Yeah. I think 89 was the last gasp of the sympathetic prep.
Yeah.
We were all for them and they were aspirational all through the 80s. Yeah. And then the 90s kind of like, no, we're in the grunge era now. These guys suck.
We knew what was that. Those were going to be the guys to ruin the fucking world. It's their fault.
Right. But he's got like a small part in a movie that I really love called Nobody's Fool with Paul Newman.
Paul Newman.
He gets punched out by
Bruce Willis
Paul Newman
as well.
Yeah, and Bruce Willis in that as well. I mean, that's a really nice against type performance by Bruce as well. Mm. But I think it was really in 96 where he sort of busted out because he's in Twister.
Yeah, that's right.
He's almost too much in Twister. I mean, he's really going for it. He's kind of like he's the wild man of the storm chasing posse. And he's putting.
But it does suit the kind of ridiculousness of the premise. You know what I mean? Like he knows what film he's in.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it seems like most of the team, most of Helen Hunt's team are kind of like, oh, you know, we're outsiders, we're mavericks. And then PSH just comes in and he's like, wait, I think they go to that old lady's house and he's like, oh, well, they almost make a steak. Like, food, we want food. Give us food. It's like, what are you doing, man? But he's in Hard Eight, I think the same year, PTA's
first film,
feature. And he's got this one scene in it where he's this gambler on the craps table opposite Philip Baker Hall. And he's just really going for it. I mean, I think he's either got great instincts or he's got such out there instincts that, you know, directors will just go, I trust you, even though, you know, this just seems wild. I mean, he's got that bit where he's going, I'm going to smoke the cigarette, going to smoke it, going to smoke this cigarette, old man. You know, and he's saying things like, inka dinka doo, inka dinka dinka. It's like, the fuck are you doing, PSH? But you just remember it, and you're like, and you look at it in the context of the body of work, and it's like, this guy does something different every time, and he swings for the fences every time, and more often than not, he connects. Then you've got post Boogie Nights, and the 90s into the 2000s, like, oh, well, this guy is the next De Niro, or he's the next Dustin Hoffman. He's just anything he can do, he's commanding the screen, he's inventive, he'll just steal a movie out from under you if you don't watch out. So when in 2004 he takes on a role in this kind of semi-lowbrow rom-com opposite Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston called Along Came Polly, and again, he just walks off with the movie, but he's playing essentially the 80s slob best friend.
Yes, you know? It's like the Reese Ifans role from Notting Hill.
Like, yeah, or like, oh, did Jim Belushi pass on this? Why are Hoffman doing it? But again, he commits. Yeah. He finds the actual truth and core of the character, but he also just plays, Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack.
Yeah, it has that like total kind of frat boy comedy setup of, so he's a washed up actor, right? A former child star.
Actor. Yeah.
Or whatever. A gluttonous, you know, kind of slobbish ex-child star.
Pure appetite. Yeah.
And it has that vague sketch of a character, but what he does with it, because he's so, he and Jack Black, the thing that I think makes them such adept comedic performers is they are quite graceful, like in terms of their physicality and their physical comedy. Like he can do a pratfall really well, but then later on there's like a musical number where he's doing like the school play or whatever with the kids and he's in the big grey leotards and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, the way he moves, because he's such a, you know, he looks so portly, but then he moves with such kind of grace and elegance. It's like it just adds to the comedy.
He really knows how to use his body very, very well. But the fact that he's playing, a character that you would normally sort of think is a go-to for, and I don't mean any disrespect when I say this, but for Jack Black.
Mm.
But it's given to the guy who, you know.
An Oscar-winning actor. Yeah. Oscar-caliber actor, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. Have you seen, there's a deleted scene in Punch Drunk Love where they shot a whole bunch of like fake ads for the character who's playing his mattress store. I've watched this scene like, and I just can't work. And it's him walking along the top of a bus playing his guitar. And he's like, come down and like Mattress World and we'll get you a discount. And then he jumps off the bus and lands on the mattress, but then does this really awkward flip and lands on his head and like gets carried off. It. And I was like, is that for real? Because it's based on an actual ad, because I looked it up and it's like they based it on an actual, you know, some regional commercial for a mattress guy in the States. But I'm like, if that is a like CGI, it is brilliant because there's no explanation. It's just in the bonus features of Punch Drunk Love of him bouncing off and smashing his head. But it's again like that physical comedy in the same way that I guess Sandler got taken out of his normal environment and put in Punch Drunk Love. You could almost argue that, you know, the character from Along Came Polly shares something in common with the character in Punch Drunk Love. It's just amped up to be more sinister and imposing.
Absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, I think just, for me it was the fact that it's like, oh, God, here's this guy who's, you know, working with the premier filmmakers of his time who seems to be like a, I've got to find something for Philip Seymour Hoffman in my movie, you know. I don't care if it's a bit part. I don't care if it doesn't seem right. He'll make it work and my film will be better as a result. Yeah, for him to be in this, let's be honest, a fairly forgettable rom-com, he just sort of – kicks it up several notches just by his presence. And not just him. I think it was something that really that I really got a kick out of in Along Came Polly, which I don't really remember a lot of that of other than these two actors, is Hoffman and Alec Baldwin. Because, of course, Alec Baldwin had been on SNL a few times at this stage. He was, I don't know if he was part of the Five Timers Club by this stage of the proceedings, but, you know, there are guys that they always bring back because it's like, oh, yeah, they're actually, we like having them around and they're really funny. And, but, you know, I don't think Australian people would have known a whole lot about
that. Pre-30 Rock, right? 2004.
Yeah, this is pre-30 Rock. But him in this, he's sort of, I think in the opening scene where Stiller's getting married to this woman who will eventually betray him and that sort of sets up his whole risk aversion thing. Baldwin is kind of doing this very, I don't know if it's a stereotypical Jewish accent or something, but I'm glad you're here to help celebrate Reuben's wedding and all this kind of stuff. It's like, again, I didn't expect this from Alec Baldwin, who's normal, who was
so stoic. Yeah, again, leading man.
He's a versatile player, but generally the archetypal leading man. Yeah. Yeah, and then, with 30 Rock, he sort of steers into like, no, I'm actually a clown and a really good one. I mean, I'd stack his performance on 30 Rock up against just about anyone in sitcoms.
I mean, sometimes it doesn't work though, does it? Like the against type, like when Russell Crowe did A Good Year for Ridley Scott and he's trying to play like a Cary Grant-esque, you know, like screwball comedy character. I remember I was writing reviews at the time. And like the analogy I used was like trying to was watching a bull tiptoe through a china shop. It's like, he knows what he needs to do, but he has that physicality of being Russell Crowe, and you just couldn't quite buy it because of either the persona he'd created, you know, in the previous films, or just what we knew about him. Like, I admire the balls to go for it and to try and do like this. You know, it's meant to be just a really relaxed romantic comedy, but it just comes across like, you can't do the Hugh Grantisms, you know, pushing your glasses up on your nose and stammering and stuff. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I remember not disliking A Good Year, but thinking that, and I again, sort of respecting what Crowe was going for in it, but he just wasn't at a stage either as an actor or as a public personality because, I don't know, was this when he was throwing phones at people or
It was around that his sort of peak of his fame, like, you know, where he was the best actor in the world.
But also kind of letting you know that on occasion.
Yeah, it's funny. There's another one too. There's another performance as well that I always think of where it's like, I feel bad because, and again, you know, I'm not trying to pick on Russell Crowe or any of these people we're talking about.
Not unfunny either.
No.
But it's like when people say, oh, Christopher Nolan's never made a funny movie. It's like, well, he hasn't made slapstick, but I mean, there's laughs in just about everything.
And yeah, that's right.
They're very dry and they're very droll, but they're there. Likewise, you know, I love it how Russell Crowe just keeps telling terrible jokes all through Master and Commander. And everyone's like, we have to play along because he's the captain.
There's a scene in Lantana where Glenn Robbins makes an appearance in a completely straight role as like the husband or something. And I remember being in the cinema and people literally, because it's quite a heavy film, Lantana. Yeah. And when he came on screen, like there was an audible like, because everyone in the audience is like, we can relax. We're going to get some comedic relief. But then it's like he's this browbeaten kind of mealy-mouthed husband. It's like, why did you cast a guy who like has that's Russell Coit. Like people see him and they immediately want to laugh. Like he just has that face and that persona. But I mean, so how you deploy your against type casting is also incredibly important, right? Like you don't want to deflate the kind of tone of your scene or your movie.
It really is. I mean, I think Robin Williams sort of fumbled a few times before he realized you've got to do it very, very gradually, you know, and I think Dead Poets Society was kind of like, he's still throwing in a few of his traditional Robinisms, but he's also got parts where he's like very sensitive and, you know, very sad and like, more strings to the bow. And then, you know, eventually you get to full on dramatic performances or performances are 90% dramatic with just the odd one liner thrown in. Likewise with Jim Carrey and Truman Show.
The last actor I want to bring up is one of my absolute favorite films of all time, is Sexy Beast, starring Sir Ben Kingsley. Now, I had to sort of double check when I thought of this one because I'm like, because he has played villains before and they're not all, but I did a quick scan of his resume and I'm like, he has played bad guys, but it's more I'd put him and Begbie on par as being two of the most intimidating, if slightly built, characters on screen, playing Don Logan in Sexy Beast. And it is just a powerhouse performance, especially when you're paired. Like, it's such brilliant casting when you put him up against Ray Winston, who is physically imposing and is just like, feels like everything is just heavy about him. And to see him cowering next to this like little Indian man because of, you know, you've got this opportunity to, you've got the chance to turn this opportunity. Yes. Like, it's just, it's fucking brilliant. Such a great performance, but also like equal parts chilling and thrilling. Like, you just love watching Don go for it and the things he says, and it's just like, oh my God, like, it's just so toxic. Yeah, if Robert Carlyle had done what was the cop he played, the Scottish cop, the
Hamish Macbeth.
Hamish Macbeth, if he'd played that and then done Begbie, he would be in his slot. But I'm going to put Ben Kingsley in because it's Gandhi as a fucking psychotic English gangster.
It is. I mean, and I don't know, you think about, Kingsley prior to this in a villainous role and be like, oh, yeah, I could see him as Hannibal Lecter. Yeah, he's got that kind of
intellectual,
a stillness, intellectual. Yeah, I could buy him as that who could really get into your head. You know, Don Logan will get into your head with a hammer. Yeah. It's like, well, I'm sorry to keep saying that, but I didn't see it coming. Or it's like, that's such great counterintuitive casting. It's a gamble. I hope it pays off. And when it pays off, it's like, oh, my God, it's like you've hit the 777s at the slot machines. Ah, this money just keeps on coming.
You know, a similar bit of against type casting that was on my list as well is Patrick Stewart in Green Room, where he plays like a neo-Nazi. And it's for exactly those reasons you just named, which is like he has that urbane kind of intellectual quality, but then it's partnered with this really ugly, dark, like white nationalist ideology, and it just becomes everything that you love about Patrick Stewart is suddenly subverted, and it's like, oh God, he's using his charm and his intellect for ill.
Yeah, he's Picard, but for the next generation of Nazis. I mean, he's not Picard-y. Doing anything. He's not doing anything that different. That's not a slam on like, oh, he's one note. He's like, no, I'm deploying, like you said, what I'm best known for. But if you view it through this lens, it's like, oh, shit. You know, I mean, of course you're going to follow this guy. He's Professor X.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And Sexy Beast also contains like one of my favorite openings to a film, which is like just an inner monologue of Ray Winston. Fat, sweaty Ray Winston sunbaking outside his Spanish villa, and his internal monologue of like, I'm just a big bit of bacon, just sizzling away. And then a giant boulder falls into the swimming pool, and it's like, I don't know what this film is, but I mean, it's such a good opening.
I'm just a big bit of bacon. Have you heard about the Sexy Beast sort of prequel series that's on TV now?
I literally, preparing for this episode, just saw it then. I had no idea there was a TV series based on Sexy Beast.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I don't have Paramount Plus and I don't know. I mean, I could sign up and get the get the preview deal or whatever, but it's like, I don't know if I'm that interested. I mean, Paramount especially seems to be really trawling through their back catalogue. It's like, let's do a reimagining of Fatal Attraction. Let's do a prequel about the Pink Ladies from Greece. They're really sort of tapping into their IP and often with sort of diminishing returns. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this Sexy Beast TV series could be good, but
it could be the MASH of 2024. Inspired by a movie but runs much longer.
It could be the aftermath of MASHes. One last thing. Just one other thing about Kingsley as well. I mean, he's sort of played villain since, but he's never really gone back to the Don Logan well.
Yeah.
The closest he came was in this little scene movie, a serial killer thriller called Suspect Zero.
You ever
heard of that one?
No.
It's pre-bricklayer Aaron Eckhart.
Oh, really? Shit.
It's one of those movies. On a previous video store, we talked about movies we wish were 25% better.
Yeah, yeah.
Suspect Zero is one of those where it's like, you've got a good idea and you've got some good execution, some halfway decent ideas, but not quite. So that's a shame. Yeah. We're up to my final choice.
Final nomination, please.
This role, I think, gave a second career, or at least a second parallel career to an actor who was doing pretty well at this stage. But it's Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow opposite Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Now, I'm intrigued by this nomination because when you sent it to me, I was like, what is an Emily Blunt type? I can't think of what she's known for. So explain to me the gear shift.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I think I might have sort of jumped the gun a little bit because I just remember seeing Edge of Tomorrow and going, wow, Emily Blunt's kicking ass. This is fantastic. And then not realizing that maybe 2 years before she'd been in Looper.
But not playing an ass kicker though.
No, wielding a pump action shotgun very adeptly. And being someone who was tough, but not necessarily an ass kicker.
Military trained.
Yeah.
You know. I'll let you have a pass on that. I think it is a different enough character. She's playing, you know, like fiercely protective mother in Looper, not like mercenary or, you know, highly trained marine.
Yeah. But when it comes to what you'd call an Emily Blunt role, you're right. I mean, she sort of broke out in The Devil Wears Prada, and that was a literal breakout performance because everyone's like, oh my God, who's this? She'd done a few things beforehand, but it's like, oh, you know, she's, you know, incredibly beautiful, but also very funny, but also kind of like snarky, the scariest woman you'd ever meet. It's incredibly stylish. How can we deploy this woman? How can we, you know, make really good use of her, you know, in Hollywood movies? And, you know, she appeared in a few, yeah, costume epics. I think she was, you know, the young Queen Victoria in aptly The Young Victoria. did that thing where it's like she's got equal billing opposite, say, Matt Damon or someone like that. And it's like, yeah, you're doing really well in this. I like watching you. You're probably not that you're better than Matt Damon, but your character seems like you would overpower Matt Damon's character, all that kind of business. So I don't think it was really until, for mine at least, until Edge of Tomorrow, where she gets to show off all these different attributes. She's got a very wry sense of humor. She's got a terrific physicality that you really buy, like Gina Davis in Long Kiss Goodnight. I mean, the story of Edge of Tomorrow is that, you know, she sort of lives, dies, repeats all through these various days and turns into a bit of a super warrior as a consequence. And then the same thing happens to Tom Cruise, and she has to sort of teach him how to become this, super warrior of the future.
And that's a fairly against type performance as well. I know Tom Cruise, we've said, is out of bounds because he's just a good actor. But even for Tom Cruise standards, like that is he's a coward for like 90% of the film, you know. And even when he finds his courage, it's like it's more of a Tom Hardy-esque role than a Tom Cruise role.
Yeah, well, it's like he's playing Jerry Maguire in a sci-fi action movie.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
Because he's like, I love it when, you know, at the start of Edge of Tomorrow where Brendan Gleeson's basically saying, okay, well, yeah, you've done a very good job of selling the invasion. Now we're going to put you on the front line to really sell it even more. I don't do that. Can we think of other ways to maybe, you know, work around this? And Brendan Gleeson, no, you go to the front.
You know what I also love about Edge of Tomorrow is, like, I think so often in sci-fi films they get so lazy in their depiction of what a completely alien species would look like. It's either humanoid or it's based on something we've already seen before. Yeah. But this film and Arrival, like, sought to do something completely different in the way they represented an alien life form, like a non-carbon-based life. What does that even mean? And I still don't quite understand how those aliens work, like what they are. And it's such a memorable, interesting, like off-putting, yet still kind of like, you know, vaguely beautiful kind of design. And I really admire, you know, that Doug Liman, right?
It is, yeah.
They attempted to put something on camera that we hadn't seen before, you know, because I think that's the hardest thing with sci-fi is like, how do you think up a completely new species that has like completely different physiology and how it moves and operates?
Evil electric dead dreadlocks is what they look like.
That's exactly what I was thinking more of, like those needle, you know, those needle pads where you make an impression of your hand and stuff, like a constantly vibrating needle pad.
Yeah, but Blunt in it is, you know, continually kicking ass, constantly sort of showing Cruise up. I mean, it's not wanting to, again, blow smoke up Cruise's ass, but, I mean, it's generous work by Cruise, and it's like, I'm definitely going to take a backseat to someone who is very, very adept at screen heroics here. I mean, again, sorry to break out the iconic word, but, you know, there's a bit where she's in the sort of the training area and she's planking or something, and you sort of see her do this very smooth curve up, and it's like the architecture of your arms and shoulders is like, yeah. I don't know, who's a great sculptor, Rodin or someone. It's like, it's just incredible. And, you know, I don't know, she sort of does ever well since, across the board. It's a leading man performance in a female body.
Ever since Linda Hamilton did pull-ups in T2, yeah. Like the bar has been set for every female action hero afterwards. Yeah. I call them Pilates arms. It's that they're lean muscle, rounded shoulders with lean muscle. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like, oh, that person does a lot of Pilates.
But I'm a huge fan of Edge Tomorrow. It's just got one of the great endings of all time. Just, you know, not to spoil, but, you know, the enemy has been defeated and they're back at a stage where Cruz and Blunt have gone through the same thing, except she doesn't remember it. And the last shot is Cruz just sort of like, how the fuck am I going to explain this to her? Just laughing. It's like, that's perfect. I love that ending. It's great.
Well, they're making a sequel, aren't they? That's on the
cards.
They're
talking about it. Yeah. I mean, Cruz and Blunt and Lyman have sort of said, yeah, we've got a really good idea, one that really works. And Edge of Tomorrow has, I don't know if it flopped on release, but it certainly didn't do as well as you would expect a Tom Cruise sci-fi action movie to do, but it's really gained a cult reputation and a great deal of regard over the years.
They should have gone with the original title. That's the problem.
What, Live, Die, Repeat. Yeah.
Like, I think just about every is so vague and doesn't describe anything. Isn't it?
Yeah. I think every home video release since then really has Live, Die, Repeat very heavily featured on the cover. And for Blunt, you know, post that, you know, she's in Sicario, which I think she's Quiet really, really Place. Good in. The Quiet Place and its sequel, Jungle Cruise, I guess. but she was also in a limited series that's on Amazon Prime called The English. It's a Western where she plays this English woman who goes to the Old West. She's sort of in search of I think her husband's gone out there, but he's been killed, and now she's sort of searching for his killer. I saw a few episodes and been like, I need to keep watching this because it's really, really good, and she's great in it. So, but she continues to sort of do, you know, various things. I mean, she was Mary Poppins in that sort of sequel that didn't really take off as well as Disney thought it might, I'm sure. But, she's still working. Well, she's Oscar-nominated for Oppenheimer.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't think she's going to have trouble getting work, but it would be awesome to see if she does go back to the Live, Die, Repeat world, just to sort of see her, what she does next, because I think we've seen the Sarah Connor. Now, I don't know, maybe she can be a bit more grizzled, maybe a bit more furiosa, lose an arm or something like that. Guy, thank you for stepping.
Furiosa just quickly, by the way, because
we should touch on Furiosa. Yes.
You contacted me after the trailer dropped and you're like, what do we think about that trailer?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I trust George. Like, I have all the faith in Dr. George, but it just seems so antithetical to everything we loved about Fury Road. And I do have some, you know, some industry people that I know that I messaged as well. And the word I got is that was a rushed trailer release. That was pressure put on them by Warner Brothers to say, you need to get something out because we have to promote. Mm. So those visual effects are not finished. But, yes, there is much more green screen work in this film than the other one. And when I've just finished reading, The Chrome Dust, What a Love, whatever it's called, the oral history of Fury Road, and no one would choose to make a film like that again. It's fucking insane. No. The fact that they pulled it off once. Like, I am not going to begrudge Dr. George for, like, let's shoot in a comfy studio with some green screen this time. So I'm withholding my judgment. I just feel like what I loved about, like, Fury Road is it felt so visceral and authentic in the sense that not just the stunts, but, like, the makeup and the world, and they created, you know, gone to such lengths. Whereas I just sort of see Chris Hemsworth with a fake nose on, and then you see some dodgy green screen. I'm like, oh, this just doesn't feel the same. But like I said, I'm willing to reserve my judgment till the film comes out.
That's the thing, because, yeah, I mean, the first Fury Road trailer, it was like, mind blown, and this one's kind of like...
Well, I remember, like, the first Fury Road trailer, like, if you're a Mad Max fan, like, it did feel completely different to Road Warrior.
Absolutely.
Like, it was saturated and kinetic, and the whole thing felt, you know, just much more kind of, like, vibrant and less post-apocalyptic and more just kind of insane, or camp in a way, like, just, like, insane.
Operatic,
that's a good term. I just don't know. Like, I want to believe that's. I'll leave it at that. We'll have to revisit when the film comes out, because I just don't know yet.
To say in the Doctor We Trust.
Yeah, in the Doctor We Trust. Guy, thank you for coming back into the video store. If people want to hear you or find you online, where can they do those things?
If you're hanging around the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, you can find me at Robert Guy Davis. And if you want to hear more of these dulcet tones, by all means, do you tune into podcasts?
Go on, download, follow, subscribe.
Like and subscribe to Four-Finger Discount, where my co-host Brendan Dando and myself are breaking down every episode of The Simpsons, occasionally talking about classic episodes with fantastic guest stars. We had Bulldogs footballer Tom Liberatore on yesterday, talking about his many and varied Simpsons tattoos.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you can check all those out. There's a link in the episode description to hear the podcast, and give the guy a follow if you find him on the site formerly known as Twitter. But that is a video store. We'll be back at some point. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Guy Davis.
Listener.